that I cut my words off as if I had just realized what I was saying.
You have no idea, Elvina said. Most people don't appreciate the cook's position. Gastric trouble is cook trouble. There's always someone willing to point the finger.
So I suppose, in a way, it was a good thing that she drowned. I know that must sound awful, but... Elvina gave off a nervous laugh. It was time to get my feet on firmer ground. I know what you mean when you say she was a trooper, I said. She presented one of the awards at the Beaux Arts Ball the night she was taken ill, didn't she?
Nothing to do with me, Elvina said. Bit of bad lobster at the ball. That's what Dr. Ainsmith said. I never saw her again, so I wouldn't know.
Never saw her again? I leapt on her words like a hound on a bone.
No, never. Dr. Ainsmith brought her home and had invalid soup sent over from the nursing home.
Did she eat it? I asked.
Must have. The bowls came down empty in the morning, and she was off to the cruise on the second day.
My veins were throbbing like plucked harp strings. Dr. Rainsmith must have been devastated, I said. Even though Miss Fawthorne says that the second Mrs. Rainsmith was a great comfort.
I expect she was, Elvina said, not looking at me.
Yes, I expect she was. There fell a great silence, and we all of us sat thinking our own thoughts, each of us cradling our teacups in our hands as if it were a family trait we shared. For the first time in many weeks, I felt at home. I could have stayed here forever in this cozy kitchen. I could have kissed the table and hugged the chairs. But of course I didn't. Instead, I offered up a little prayer of thanks to the Michaelmas daisies and to Saint Michael himself, who had brought me here.
Can I run you home? Merton asked. I expect you'll be wanting to get back, and it's a long walk.
How could I tell him that in my heart I was already at home, and that a ride to anywhere else would take me farther from it, that by departing I would be in some way diminished? Thank you, Mr. Merton, I said. I'd be much obliged. The street lights were coming on as we drove along the Danforth. May I ask you a question? I said.
Of course, miss, Merton said.
What was Francesca Rainsmith wearing the night of the Beaux Arts Ball? Merton smiled, and then he laughed aloud.
A Cinderella costume, he said. Tattered gingham dress, apron, hair in a bandana, Charlie Chaplin boots with red socks sticking out. She was ever so proud of the get-up. One of the girls helped her make it. No more than a girl herself, Miss Francesca was. We miss her.
I'm sorry, I said. I wish I'd had the chance to meet her. We drove in silence for a while.
How are you finding it? Merton asked. Miss Bodycote's Female Academy, I mean.
Frankly, Mr. Merton, I said, just between you and me and the gatepost, it's a bugger. And I think by the look on his face that he knew what I meant. Miss Fawthorne was, as I knew she would be, livid. In its proper sense, the word livid is used to describe someone who is black in the face from strangulation, and I wasn't far off. Her countenance was ghastly.
Where have you been? She demanded, her voice trembling.
I went for a walk, I said, which was true, as far as it went.
The whole academy has been turned out looking for you. Do you realize that?
Of course I didn't. I had only just come in the door.
We thought you'd been abducted. We...
She was suddenly speechless. Why ever would they think that? Did they know something that I didn't? I left a note on your desk, I said.
but realizing, even as I spoke, that Miss Fawthorne was near tears, and that it was no time for childish games. "I'm sorry," I said, and left it at that. Of course, I wanted to tell her about my worrying about Collingwood, my visit to the nursing home, my interview with Merton and Alvina, but I didn't. The time was not yet right. I needed more facts and more time to gather them. "I'll go to my room," I said, saving her the trouble. I lay on my bed reflecting upon A, my wickedness, and B, the fact that I hadn't eaten all day. Thank goodness for the box of biscuits I was buying on the hire purchase plan from the grocer's on the Danforth. I had borrowed the down payment from Fabian with the promise to repay at 25% interest as soon as I received my first allowance from home, even though my hopes in that direction were beginning to fade. Dogger's letter was the only communication I had received from Buckshaw since my incarceration. Dear Dogger. I bit savagely into a cream cracker, willing myself to summon him up in spirit, if not in fact. I tried to picture the two of us, heads bent together over a bubbling beaker, nodding wisely as the liquid changed colour, and another neck was in the noose. But it was no use. Magic doesn't work when you're sad. I realized that I had been putting off a visit to the laboratory for that very reason, which came as something of a shock. I needed to deal with things head on. Someone had pinned a handwritten note to the door of the lab. All chemistry classes cancelled until further notice. Underneath it, someone else had penciled, "Praise be to St. Jude for prayers answered." And someone else had written, in red ink, "Down with chems." I looked both ways to make sure no one was coming, and slipped inside. With the green blinds closed and dusk out of doors, the room was in near darkness, which suited me to perfection. I would not easily be seen through the window in the door or from the outside. I turned on a low-powered light in an alcove and got to work. Excited as I was, it was still necessary to follow the rules. I turned on the fan, which would exhaust any fumes from the hood which covered the work area. More than one chemist in days gone by had, while conducting the Marsh test, sniffed at his apparatus and died in agony. I pulled the silver medallion from my pocket. Fortunately, I had remembered to wrap it in a bit of cellophane for protection before tying it back into a knot in my handkerchief. As I set up the required glassware, I was possessed by the old familiar thrill, like the vicar in the run-up to the consecration. I was about to witness a transformation at my very fingertips, to be glorified by the gods of chemistry. The Marsh test is not only simple and elegant, but also the most theatrical of the chemical procedures. How many sleuths in fact and fiction have hunched tensely over that telltale flame? It is that hushed moment, just before the final curtain, when all the world seems to hold its breath. The moment when nothing more than a tiny, flickering, and nearly invisible flame will either send the accused to the gallows or set him free. It was James Marsh, the ordnance chemist of the Royal Arsenal at Woolwich, who recognized that nascent, meaning newly generated, hydrogen, whenever brought into contact with any compound of arsenic and oxygen, will produce water and arseniuretted hydrogen, otherwise known as arsine, an extremely poisonous gas with the chemical formula ASH3 and the odor of garden fresh garlic. His test is so sensitive that it is able to detect as little as 2 parts in a million of arsenic. These days, of course, the idea of newborn hydrogen having superior powers is generally pooh-poohed, and it is now believed that age does not wither its ability to finger a felon.
Oxygen is oxygen is oxygen, they say. Although Dogger, being old-fashioned, doubts this. I dropped a bit of zinc into the bottom of the U-shaped tube, then filled it somewhat more than half full with sulfuric acid. With a small twist of surgical cotton, I wiped off about a quarter of the shiny black tarnish from the medallion and dropped the swab into the left side of the tube, sealing it with a glass stopper. The swab began to char and turn black as it was carbonized by the sulfuric acid. The zinc at once began to bubble in the acid. Hydrogen was being born. And, if my hunch was right, arsine. The stoppered right side of my U-shaped container led off through a slender glass tube, which ended in an upturned tip. I waited for about 30 seconds, lit a match, held it to the tip of the exhaust tube and... poof! A flame. Burning red, burning orange, burning blue. I reached for an unglazed pottery dish, flipped it over, and held its underside to the flame, much as a freezing schoolboy home for the holidays holds his bottom to the family fireplace. A circular dark patch began to form around the outer edges of the flame, brownish at first, but quickly turning black and shiny. An arsenic mirror in which, if I were any judge, the image of a murderer would soon be reflected. This wasn't the end of it by any means. First, I needed to place a few drops of sodium hypochlorite in solution on part of the newly formed mirror. If the sooty deposit was soluble and vanished, it was arsenic. If it remained, it was arsenic's cousin, antimony. And then, of course, I needed to repeat the experiment with clean, uncontaminated glassware and a fresh and untreated swab. This would be my control, or reference, and should result in no formation of an arsenic mirror. I leaned back from the little pool of light to think about what I had discovered, about what it would mean for me, and for several others. Once I made my findings known, Miss Bodycote's Female Academy would never be the same again. It was at that moment that a voice from out of the darkness behind me said, "Very clever." Chapter 28. I spun round, my eyes only slowly adjusting to the darkened room. From out of the shadows, a figure was moving slowly toward me. It was Fabian. "Very clever," she said again as she came half into the light, and I could see the tight-lipped smirk on her pale face. "How long have you been there?" I asked, trying to inject a touch of outrage into my voice.
"Longer than you," she said, fishing a packet of cigarettes from her pocket and putting a match to one, then tossing her hair like French women in the cinema.
"You were expecting me then," I said. But other than blowing out a dismissive stream of smoke, she did not bother to reply.
"What made you think of the Marsh test?" she asked. "What made you think of arsenic?"
I shrugged. "Just a guess," I lied.
"I'll bet it was," she said.
"We could have stood there all night, I suppose, fencing with words, until one or the other of us decided to use something more deadly." I saw my chance, and I went for it. "But you already knew that, didn't you, that it was arsenic?"
"Of course I did," she smiled, taking a satisfied puff.
"I was there when she swallowed it."
"What?"
"The night of the Beaux Arts Ball, 2 years ago.
I was there.
I must have looked like a gaping loony."
"Some of us were asked to serve at table. Jumbo, Drews, Forrester, myself. A few of the faculty as well. Miss Falthorne, Miss Moat, Mrs. Bannerman, Miss DuPont. It's something of a tradition," Fabian went on, "meant to show up the democratic principles of the old hall, even if it's only once a year.
Jolly good of Miss Moat to pitch in, I said. It mustn't be easy for her.
Modi's a good sort, Fabian said, flicking ashes on the floor. Her bark is worse than her bite.
I nodded, even though I didn't agree. I was still trying to sort out where Fabian and I stood, which side we were on, and what was behind this jewel in a shadowed room. Which one of us, for instance, was darkness, and which of us was light?
She's had a hard row to hoe, Fabian said, since the accident, that is, ditched by her best friend.
Ditched? I was missing something here.
Fabian saw my look of dismay. Run off the road and into the ditch. Car flipped, Modi flung out through the windshield, broken spine, broken neck. They practically had to pick up her bits in a basket. I felt my gorge rising. Those injuries would account for that awful froggish expression into which her face had fallen. The poor woman must have undergone eons of surgery.
It was positively eerie, Fabian said, echoing my thoughts, to see her at high table, serving lobster to the very person who put her in the wheelchair. I blinked blankly.
Francesca Rainsmith, she said, her one-time best friend.
My throat was suddenly dry. I was finding it hard to swallow. I thought of all those long-gone chemists who had accidentally inhaled a fatal dose of arsine and died with their legs in knots behind their necks. Or had I, without paying attention, taken a drink of water from a contaminated glass? But no, other than the shock of hearing about Miss Moat, I had exhibited no symptoms.
Why are you telling me this?
I asked. We were still circling each other as warily as two roosters in a ring, and I had already made up my mind not to be the first to mention pheasant sandwiches. If she was a member of the Nide, she could jolly well bring it up herself.
Because you need to know, she said. I've had my eye on you for some time. I shrugged. What else could I do?
You say you were actually there when the arsenic was administered?
I think so, she said. I was sitting across from Francesca when Modi brought her a plate of lobster.
From the sideboard?
Can't say. I had my back to it. Oddly enough, I remember Modi lifting her beloved tea cozy from the plate.
She brought Francesca's lobster under her tea cozy?
Doesn't make sense, does it? I didn't think much about it at the time, although I do remember thinking that our beloved chairman might have salted her plate with something nasty. He made such a show of breaking up the lobster for her, the claws, the abdomen. She squealed and closed her eyes at the sight of the antennae.
Made her feel sick, just looking at them, she said.
Funny, isn't it? Strange was more the word that came to mind. But then Miss Moat's oversized tea cozy was big enough to conceal almost anything you might wish to put under it.
Which raised a whole new set of possibilities.
Which one of them was it, then? Ryerson Rainsmith or Miss Moat?
I don't know, Fabian said with a sigh. I really don't.
Why didn't you tell anyone? I asked. The police, for instance.
Fabian regarded me with a distant eye, and then she said, I have my reasons. I could have named one of them on the spot, but I didn't. I decided to steer the conversation into less personal channels, at least for now.
We have to be very cautious with seafood poisoning, I said. Mussels, clams, scallops and oysters contain organic forms of arsenic. So do crabs and lobsters. I never thought I'd find myself in the position of defending Ryerson Rainsmith, but it's a funny old world, and when it comes to poisons, it's always best to watch your step. A hanged man can't be unhanged.
and besides, I didn't think I could stand being made a fool of.
The Marsh test can't distinguish between the various forms of arsenic, I said. But since no one else died at the Beaux-Arts Ball, I think that we can assume, at least for the moment, that Francesca Rainsmith's poison came from somewhere other than the lobster's natural toxicity.
The lobster was just a cover. Is that what you're saying?
It might have been, I said. And then again, it might not.
Fabian fixed me with a long stare, then shook her head.
You're a strange one, Deluce. I can't figure you out.
Neither can I, I said. So tell me more about the night of the ball.
It was as it always was. Long tables, alternate seating, faculty, student, faculty, student. Democratic principles, remember. No hierarchy, everyone equal, that sort of thing.
Hold on, I said. How was it that the chairman was seated next to his wife? You did say that, didn't you?
Fabian said. I hadn't thought of that. Unless it just worked out that way because of the number of chairs.
So, I said, changing the subject, Miss Moat produces Francesca's plate of lobster from under her tea cozy. The chairman breaks it up for her, and she tucks into a hearty meal. Is that it?
Pretty well, Fabian said. I was busy dismembering my own lobster, mind you, and it was a chore. One hates to splatter one's neighbors with melted butter and intestinal juices. One tries to be ladylike.
And Francesca?
Oh, she seemed to be getting on quite well, chatting up the girls for a while anyway. She was the center of attention in her Cinderella get-up.
What about the chairman? Was he in costume too?
Fabian snorted. I should say not. He's above that sort of thing.
What about the prizes? I asked. Didn't Francesca present one of them?
Yes, Fabian said.
I think so. Oh, yes, of course she did.
The St. Michael Award, I said, for church history.
Yes.
To Clarissa Brasenose.
Yes.
Who vanished later that same night.
So they say, Fabian said.
And what do you say?
Fabian lit another cigarette with the same mannerisms as before.
You mustn't put too much stock in what the younger kids say, she said, blowing out the match with as much force as if it were a forest of candles on the birthday cake of 100-year-old.
Their minds are full of nonsense. Ghost stories, fairy tales. They're easily spooked.
I'm not asking what the younger girls say. I'm asking what you say.
I say, who knows? People come and go all the time. It's the nature of schools. She might have been sent down, gated, failed to flourish.
Yes, I said, she might have.
This whole game of to and fro, this whole game of put and take, this whole game of cat and mouse with Fabian was getting me down. And yet, it was somehow strangely familiar. I realized with an almost physical start that it was the same rigmarole I had often fallen into with Feely, a parlor game where persistence paid and only the bold survived.
About Francesca, I said, with a cucumber-cool expression on my face. She gave out the St. Michael Award. And then what?
I don't know, Fabian said. I suppose I noticed she had become more quiet. Withdrawn, you might say, touching her napkin to her lips a lot. She seemed to be growing paler by the minute. Wiped her brow a lot, too. Although it was hot, you know. June, crowded room, stuffy, too many bodies. Not that she wasn't trying to remain on the rails. She asked Clarissa if she could have a better look at the medallion she had just presented. Stared at it as if she were trying to remember where she was and what she was doing. Then she whispered to her husband. He helped her to her feet, said something to Miss Falthorne and Miss Dawes.
Miss Dawes, I interrupted.
You've lost me. Dorsey Dawes. Dorsey Rainsmith now? She was on the Board of Guardians at the time.
Interesting, I said. Go on.
Well, they helped Mrs. Rainsmith away from the table and out of the room. That was the last I saw of her. You could have knocked me over with a feather when I heard a couple of days later that she had drowned. The whole school felt like that. We were in shock. I suppose you don't know where they took her when they left the table?
Oh, but I do. They took her to Edith Cavell, Modi insisted.
Edith Cavell? Why on earth?
Because it was Modi's room at the time. They were renovating hers, and she had moved into Edith Cavell for the summer to get away from the paint fumes.
And whose room had it been before that? I asked.
Mine, Fabian said. Somewhere in the universe, something went click, and then another, and another, like footsteps on the tiles of time. I wanted to shout out, Tombola, or Bingo, or whatever they call it on this side of the pond, but I restrained myself. Already there wasn't glory enough to go around, and I didn't want to dilute it any further.
Hmm, I said instead.
This was the moment I had been waiting for.
And the chairman, I said, did you see him again? That night, I mean.
Of course. He and Dorsey, Dr. Dawes, came back and danced for hours.
With whom?
I demanded, perhaps too quickly. With everyone. He danced with students, democracy again, with faculty.
With Miss Moat?
Of course not. Don't be ridiculous.
Where was she by this time?
I don't know. She was around somewhere, I expect. I remember helping her roll up the paper garlands at the end of the night.
And the chairman, dancing, didn't he seem worried about his wife?
Didn't seem to be. Upset tummy was the word that went around. After all, he is a doctor and ought to know. Besides, it was his duty to dance with all the girls.
Yes, I said, I know, democratic principles. Did he dance with you?
Yes, twice, in fact.
Why?
How do I know, you idiot? Because I was the most beautiful girl in the room? Because he liked the smell of my Chanel? Because he likes tall girls? What a ridiculous question.
I saw that I had struck pay dirt, but I kept a poker face.
What did you talk about?
Oh, for God's sake, Duluth, how do you expect me to remember that? It was years ago.
I'd have remembered, I said. I don't often dance with a doctor. Or a man, for that matter.
What are you getting at?
Nothing, I said. It was just a thought. What did you talk about?
The weather, the heat. He said I waltzed well. He complimented me on my corsage.
Did he bid you farewell? I asked.
What do you mean? Fabian demanded.
Did he wish you well in your new life?
Whatever are you talking about, Duluth? Are you insane?
Not entirely, I said. I thought he might at least have congratulated you on winning the St. Michael Award. Clarissa. Chapter 29. I reached out and ran my finger slowly down her cheek. It came away covered with pale powder. Underneath, her exposed skin was the same swarthy shade as that of her sister, Mary Jane. Makeup, hair color, and hairstyle can fool a lot of people, I said, but the underlying facial structure can never really be changed, not in the long run anyway, and not to the professional eye. This was a fact I had learned from Dogger one rainy afternoon in the greenhouse, as we pored over photographs of criminals in the back issues of the Police Gazette he had turned out from under the stairs. We had assumed, incorrectly as it turned out, that they had belonged to Uncle Tar.
Nevertheless, Clarissa Brasenose's transformation into Fabian had been remarkable, a triumph of the actor's makeup box. Even now, with the light stain on my fingertip, there is only an inch of the real Clarissa showing through.
"You've managed to fool even your own sister," I said.
"You ought to be proud. You ought also to be ashamed. Poor kid, being made to think you were dead these past 2 years. She still doesn't know, does she? And perhaps never will." Fabian stared at me, not quite defiantly. I had to give her credit.
"How did you manage?" I asked.
"The makeup, of course, which you were taught to apply professionally. And you must have worn wigs, changed your posture, relearned how to walk. I compliment you on a most remarkable performance." I reached out as if to touch her hair. She backed slowly away out of reach.
"I haven't the faintest idea what you're talking about," Fabian said, as of course she would.
She had been trained to deny even to the death. And was I, at bottom, any different? The truth of the matter was that I hadn't the heart to expose her. If I revealed the fact that Fabian was Clarissa Brasenose, then, even though I had won, she had lost. All of her efforts and those who had trained her would be for naught. The point of it all was this. Did I have the generosity to let her get away with it? Could I let her win, throw the match, so to speak?
"I'm sorry," I said. "I must have been mistaken."
And before she could stop me, I ran out of the laboratory. I did not need more entanglements. It was only when I got back to Edith Cavell that I realized I had not completed my experiment. I would return later to clean up, when Fabian was gone. Sleep was impossible. I tossed and turned, sweated and swore. By daylight, I was a bad-tempered haystack, but I didn't care. I had made up my mind what I was going to do. I would do it and hang the consequences. Rosedale at dawn was a very different place. The weather had turned cold overnight and left the world brittle. In some of the lower spots, patches of low fog lurked among the hedges, as if the atmosphere there had curdled. Dark trees overhung the frosty grass, and the air was as sharp as knives. I walked quickly, swinging my arms to generate a bit of heat. A school blazer and white blouse were hardly meant to replace a parka, and by the time I got to the Rainsmiths, my nose was running and I was beginning to sneeze. I was not a pretty picture. Smoke was rising from the kitchen chimney as I made my way round the back of the house. I tapped lightly at the door, and Elvina opened it almost at once.
"I'm sorry to bother you," I said, "but I should like to speak with Dr. Rainsmith. It's urgent."
"Urgent, is it?" she asked, beckoning me to come inside. "So urgent that you can't have a cup of hot tea and a buttered scone? You look as if you've fallen off a dog sled."
"I'm all right," I said, resenting both the remark and the way I looked. "Is Dr. Rainsmith at home?"
"Which one?" she asked.
"The chairman," I said, "Ryerson."
Some people are shy about using the forename of an older person,
but I am not one of them.
"I'm afraid he's not, dear. He's off to a conference in Hamilton. Won't be home until tonight. Is it something that can wait?"
"No," I told her,
perhaps unwisely.
"It's a matter of life and death."
Unshaken. And it was only later that I realized that she probably dealt with matters of life and death daily, as others deal with dust. She replied,
"Is it something I can help with, or Mr. Merton? He ought to be back from the train any minute now."
"No," I said, "it's personal.
The look on her face told me that she was recalling our earlier conversation. "Honestly, I'm fine," I said, touching her hand. It was the least I could do. It was only then that I noticed that Dorsey Rainsmith was standing in the doorway. She had followed me in from the garden with a wicker basket full of flowers. I must have passed her without seeing her. Perhaps she had been bent over with her secateurs. Was it just my imagination, or had Alvina given a little jump? Had Dorsey Rainsmith taken us both by surprise? "Well," she said, "what is it?" I had no more than a second to make up my mind. Did I stay, or did I go? I thought of Alf Mullet's many talks on military tactics, which I had dozed through behind fascinated eyes.
"Confrontation is a cannon," he had said. "It's a powerful weapon, but it gives away your position."
"It's about Francesca Rainsmith," I said. No going back now. I had fired my shot and could only wait for the consequences. "You'd better come in," Dorsey said, placing the basket of flowers on the kitchen sink and leading the way through into another room, which turned out to be her study. The walls were lined with medical reference books that I'd have given my eye teeth to read, but this was hardly the time or place. She took a chair at the desk without asking me to sit, then swiveled round to face me. "I'm very busy," she said. "Good," I said. "So am I. Let's get on with it. Francesca Rainsmith." "What about her?" Dorsey said. "She died in tragic circumstances, and I'd prefer you to respect my husband's privacy and mine." "She died of arsenic poisoning at the Beaux Arts Ball," I said. "A few days later, in a wedding dress and veil, you impersonated her on a moonlight cruise."
"Quite preposterous," she said.
"Yes, it is," I replied. "Inspector Gravenhurst will find it even more so." I paused to let her guilt get to work. "He'll find the results of the autopsy particularly interesting, especially in view of the fact that you've been in charge of the body since it was discovered."
"What do you mean by that?"
"I mean, good morning, Dr. Rainsmith," I said, and turned toward the door, an effect that was largely spoiled by my being convulsed with a sneeze.
"Flavia, wait."
Reluctantly, I turned to face her again.
"Dr. Rainsmith and I, Ryerson, I mean, were on your side, you know. Pheasant sandwiches?"
She bared her teeth in a ghastly grin that was meant to be friendly, but which, to me, looked more like a corpse in a comic book. I said nothing. I was not going to let on that I recognized the phrase.
"Pheasant sandwiches?"
she said again, smiling horribly, plaintively. Again, I gave her a barn door stare.
"Listen," she said, "what do you want?"
"The truth," I said, and I must admit that those two words, as brief as they were as sweet in my mouth as milk and honey. "First of all, Collingwood, what have you done with her?"
"She's been sent home to her parents. She suffered a bad shock at Miss Bodycote's, then contracted rheumatic fever. We brought her here for a while, but she's now been released."
That much, I thought, was probably true.
"And Francesca Rainsmith?"
Dorsey Rainsmith got to her feet and locked the door. Was I terrified?
"Well, yes."
"I wish you'd wait until Ryerson comes home," she said. "I'm sure he could make it quite..." "He won't be home until late tonight," I said. "He's away at a conference."
"Oh, of course he is. I'd forgotten."
"So it's just you and me," I said. I resisted the urge to add, "sweetheart," like Humphrey Bogart.
"Talk," I told her. And she did.
I could hardly wait to tell Inspector Gravenhurst.
"So you see," I said, pacing up and down the room,
Believing she was suffering from no more than indigestion, they took Francesca to Edith Cavell. A good sleep would do her good. They left her there and went downstairs, where it was said that they danced for hours. Toward the end of the evening, when they finally got back to Edith Cavell, they found Francesca dead on the floor. Her throat had been cut. They were appalled. They panicked. After all, it had been implied that they had much more in common than medicine, if you see what I mean. He needed to return to the ball to keep up appearances, Ryerson decided. He made his excuses, left instructions that his wife was not to be disturbed, and drove Dr. Dawes home. He'd deal with things himself. It was while driving back that he came up with a plan. He remembered that Francesca had wanted to go on a midnight cruise to renew their vows. He'd already booked the tickets. There mustn't be a breath of scandal, he decided. Not about him and Miss Dawes, and certainly not about Miss Bodycote's Female Academy. When he finally got back to Miss Bodycote's, although it was quite late, there was still laughter in the ballroom. He went quietly up to Edith Cavell and found nothing. Francesca's body was gone. Not a sign of her. The room was untouched, wiped clean. What to do? There was scarcely time to think. He told Fitzgibbon he was taking his wife home. No need to make a fuss. Carry on, he'd see to it. Two nights later, they carried out their charade, with Dorsey wearing a wedding dress and veil. The gift box, of course, contained her ordinary clothing, and while Ryerson alerted the captain that his wife had fallen overboard, Dorsey was packing the wedding gear in the box and putting on a dark suit, after which she mingled with the other passengers on the deck until they returned to port. No one paid her the slightest attention. No one, remember, because of the veil, had previously seen her face. How did I discover this? Well, in the first place, Ryerson's wife banged her head getting out of the taxi at the pier. Francesca Rainsmith was tiny. Had it been she, it never could have happened. That was what first alerted me. And then the taxi. Why had they taken a taxi instead of having Merton drive them to the ship? As for the rest of it, I got it straight from Dorsey Rainsmith's mouth. I waited for this to sink in. Now then, did they kill Francesca? The answer is no. They foolishly plotted to conceal her death, but as for murder, you will find them not guilty. Francesca died of arsenic poisoning. You will almost certainly still find traces of it in her body. What made me suspect arsenic? I'm glad you asked. As you undoubtedly know, arsenic, heated, produces arsine gas. A body permeated with arsenic, wrapped in fabric, such as a flag, over time, will give off fumes that tarnish silver. I subjected a sample of the tarnish from a small silver medallion, which was clutched in the corpse's hand, to the Marsh test, which confirmed my suspicions. I'll be happy to turn it over to you so that you can verify my work. Yes, of course I ought to have handed over the medallion when you first arrived. I realize that now. But, like poor Collingwood, I must have been in shock. I hope you won't think too badly of me. And now the flag. Why was the body wrapped in a Union Jack? To absorb the blood, of course, of which there was a great deal. The flag was easily at hand, being stored in a trunk in the hall. It was flown over the Academy every 24th of May, Victoria Day. Mr. Kelly will probably confirm that it was missing last May and that he had to requisition a new one. No, I haven't asked him myself, but I have observed that there is presently a quite fresh Union Jack in the trunk, one which can't have been flown for more than a couple of days. Who, then, killed Francesca Rainsmith? The deduction is an easy one. Who held Francesca responsible for the car crash that condemned her friend to a life of torture in a wheelchair, who has hated Francesca with every moment of her waking life. I'll admit, I was being a bit dramatic here. Who is it that keeps a museum of taxidermy specimens who has the ways and means to decapitate a dead body? Who had the upper body strength to shove a pitifully little body up the chimney? Having seen the killer run a wheelchair up and down steep banks and ramps with my own eyes, I'm satisfied that we need look no further. And why decapitate? To avoid identification if the body were ever found. The skull, which is presently in the morgue, was formerly on the shelf of the Natural History Museum, here at Miss Bodycote's. And as for Francesca Rainsmith's skull, I expect you will find it on that same shelf in the same position, dyed with tea in order to age it. How do I know that? Why, I smelled it, of course. There is a definite odour of orange pekoe. Have I missed anything? Well, I suppose someone might ask how Francesca Rainsmith's killer managed to get her severed head from Edith Cavell to the museum and the replacement skull from the museum back to Edith Cavell without being spotted on the night of the Beaux Arts Ball when the place was simply crawling with people. Don't quote me on this because I'm not absolutely positive, but I suspect it has to do with an oversized tea cosy. And now, thank you for your time, Inspector. I am happy to have been of assistance. These were the things I might have said to the handsome Inspector Gravenhurst, had I been given the opportunity. But, of course, I hadn't. I had made a bargain with Wallace Scroop that he was to get the credit for figuring out the Rainsmith's Moonlight Cruise deception, and I meant to stick to it. I have to admit that I've never regretted anything in my life so much as giving up that glory. But choices are choices, and there's no going back. I didn't much mind not being able to tell the inspector that Fabian was Brazenose. But then, it's not my place to be doing his work for him, is it? Let the police carry out their own investigations. It will keep them on their toes. Fabian had, of course, given herself away by admitting that she had been at the Beaux Arts Ball and had witnessed the poisoning of Francesca Rainsmith. Rather a bad slip-up on her part. She had been present, but in the character of Clarissa Brazenose. Fabian had not been created or enrolled at Miss Bodycote's until a year ago. I hadn't mentioned in my summary her transformation into Fabian. It had puzzled me for a while why Fabian had been forced to appear without her disguise the night Scarlet had spotted her outside the laundry. I'd speculated that she might have had a bank account from which she could not withdraw funds without appearing in person. But that idea proved to be a bust when I remembered that Scarlet had seen her at night. The banks closed at 3 o'clock. As it turned out, the solution was a simple one. The Brazenose sisters have an elderly great-aunt who suffers from a form of senility, which they call hardening of the arteries. Clarissa sometimes risked sneaking out at night to visit the old lady, who lives, as it turns out, just a block away from Miss Bodycote's. Miss Fawthorne is apparently aware of this bending of the rules, but chooses to overlook it. Poor Mary Jane. She still believes her sister is dead. Will they tell her the truth one day? I don't know, but one thing's certain. I won't. Le Marchand and Wentworth will, I suppose, haunt me forever. Phantoms of Miss Bodycote's, never seen but ever present. I wonder who they are and what they are doing, and sometimes the very thought of it makes my blood run cold. I looked at myself in the mirror in which I had been rehearsing my speech to the inspector.
a speech which I knew I would never deliver. What I saw staring back at me was a plain, ordinary, somewhat dowdy schoolgirl in black tights, blue blazer, white blouse, and a Panama hat. I was dressed that way because I had been ordered to report to Miss Fawthorne's study, and full kit was the rule. I turned and marched out the door to meet my fate. Chapter 30.
"Come in," Miss Fawthorne said.
She was seated at her desk behind a pile of papers, among which was my report on William Palmer.
"Please be seated."
I sat primly on the edge of a chair, my knees together and my hands folded in my lap, leaning forward eagerly, as if I could hardly wait for my next assignment.
"You'll no doubt be happy to hear that Miss Mote has been arrested," she said, "and Mrs. Bannerman released."
I nodded sagely.
"I don't know what part you have played in these matters, and I'm not sure I want to know. If you have been instrumental in bringing the right person to justice, I congratulate you. I must say that I am relieved to learn that a person from the Morning Star, Wallace Scroope, is being commended for pointing the police to a solution. He was apparently on the scene 2 years ago, at the time of Francesca Rainsmith's death, and has never ceased making extensive private inquiries. But in doing so, he has dragged the name of Miss Bodycote's female academy into the public press. The headlines are shocking. The chairman and his wife are being questioned. Our board of guardians is a shambles. The work that we do here has been seriously compromised, if not damaged beyond repair. Fortunately for us, this Scroope cannot be made to reveal his sources, but I suspect you know nothing about that, do you?"
"No, Miss Fawthorne," I said.
"If you and Collingwood had not broken the rules at the outset, this would never have happened."
I couldn't believe my ears. Was this woman suggesting that it would be better if Francesca Rainsmith had remained shoved up the chimney for all time and her killer never brought to justice?
You must understand that reputation is paramount. There are things which, even though they be wrong, are best kept quiet for the greater good."
"The greater good? Did such a thing exist? And even if it did, who is in charge of deciding what it was?"
"Not knowing these things was like worshipping a god whose name and home address were a secret."
"I feel that we have failed, Flavia. I have failed, and you have failed." A slight chill had come upon me. Was it the room? Was it Miss Fawthorne? Or was my cold returning in full-blown form? I stifled a sneeze. Miss Fawthorne waited until I found my handkerchief. "We have done our best for you, but it has not been enough. You have broken the rules again and again, as if they didn't matter. I needn't enumerate, you know what they are." I hung my head a little, because she was right.
"Consequently," she said, dragging it out the way people do when they want to deliver an invisible blow, "we are sending you home." I was numb for a moment. "You will be escorted by Mrs. Bannerman, who has been granted a compassionate leave to compensate for her ordeal. I have cabled your father, and he will be expecting you."
Now my mind was reeling like a wobbly spinning top that has lost its velocity. Was this another one of Miss Fawthorne's famous punishments? I knew that I could never know. But the thought, the very thought of Buckshaw was already pouring like a river that has breached its banks into my mind and into my heart.
"Thank you, Miss Fawthorne,"
I said.
Epilogue. I was standing at the bow, the wind whipping my hair and what might have been sea spray wetting my face. Banished, I thought. Banished again. Was I doomed, like the Flying Dutchman, to spend all eternity sailing the seas in search of salvation? I had asked that question of Mrs. Bannerman, in somewhat simpler form, last night in the ship's lounge. Good heavens, she had said, you've passed with flying colors. Don't you realize that? I'm an FF, I said, failed to flourish, sent home in disgrace like Charlotte Veneering.
On the contrary, she laughed, your photograph will be hung in the gallery, like your mother's. You will become part of the legend.
But the rules, I said. What about the broken rules? Miss Fawthorne told me that reputation is paramount.
Ah, yes, she had said, this once convicted murderess, staring thoughtfully into her pink martini and giving it a stir.
But she also probably mentioned that there are things which, even though they be wrong, are best kept quiet for the greater good.
I had to admit, she had a point there. I'm sorry you had to be arrested, I said. I'd have spoken up sooner.
Shh, she said. Not a word of it. I told you I helped the police with their inquiries from time to time. Ambiguous, I know, but I mustn't say more. If you want to feel sorry for someone, feel sorry for poor little Collingwood. It was she who helped Francesca make her costume. And, of course, she recognized the red sock. I'm assured that she'll recover in time, but a couple of little prayers will do no harm. And with that, she bowed her head, and so did I. I keenly regret that I was unable to use either the spectrophotometer or the electron microscope in solving the case. That in the end, it had been the plain old everyday Marsh test that had done the job. Perhaps there was a lesson there. There had been no goodbyes at Miss Bodycote's, no little parties, no little gifts. I was there, and then I was gone. To the other girls, I would be just one more of those who had vanished. My name would be added to those of Wentworth, Le Marchand, and Brasenose. My spirit would be summoned in darkened rooms by Ouija boards and used to frighten little girls who were away from home for the first time. I smiled at the thought and lifted my head to the breeze. An unexpected wave dashed cold water into my face. But I didn't care. Somewhere ahead of us, to the east, lay England. Somewhere, still over the horizon, lay Buckshaw.
This is Jane Entwistle. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of As Chimney Sweepers Come to Dust, a Flavia Deluce novel by Alan Bradley. This program was directed by Kathy Thornburn. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Text copyright 2015 by Alan Bradley. Production copyright 2015, Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.